Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Carol Meerschaert from AXIS. So what can you tell me about AXIS?
Well, I will tell you that AXIS is an organization that is 30 years old. It started when a woman named Melissa wrote a letter to Ann Landers because she had an 8-year-old son who had XXY, which means he was born with an extra X chromosome. And she wrote a letter to Ann Landers and said, I can't be the only one. Can we just get together and share information? So 30 years ago, and she got 1,000 letters back. And that's how our organization began. So AXIS is the organization for X and Y chromosome variation. Now, most of us are born with either XX, so myself, being female, and most men are XY. But it turns out that about 1 in 500 people, so it's as common as red hair, are born with one or more extra sex chromosomes. So what AXIS wants to do is that we get people together to help them have fuller, more productive lives, through support, education, research, and expanding the treatment options.
So, how does the extra chromosome tend to impact a person?
In a variety of ways. What's very interesting about this is it's a spectrum disorder, sort of the way autism is, where some people are hardly affected at all, and some people are much more affected. The extra number of chromosomes, so if you, for example, have one extra X or two extra X's, the more chromosomes you have, the more affected you tend to be. The other part of it is some people are hardly affected at all, and that's why 60 to 70% of individuals never get a diagnosis. But what happens is they end up being taller than usual, have very poor muscle tone. Some people have problems with their teeth. They are more likely to have some heart problems, maybe more akin to metabolic disorder or type 2 diabetes. They have learning difficulties. So there's a variety of things that can impact, and what we find with a lot of people is once you get a diagnosis, it's like, oh, I get it. So many, many things in your life sort of come together. So you've been dealing with this invisible disability, and now you can put the whole piece together, and then the package makes sense. So the difference now is it used to be that we never knew. Men might find out because men who have an extra X, XXY, are infertile. So they tend to find out when they're, trying to have a child. Women now are finding out when they're pregnant because they're getting a prenatal test and they're pulling the mom's blood cells and she might find out she has trisomy X. But now so many more people are doing what's called non-invasive prenatal testing, where you can just draw the mother's blood when she's pregnant and check and see what's going on with the child she's carrying. Since that's new, so many more people are finding out now, which is fantastic because then she can make the decisions she wants to make. And also what she can do is then put things in motion. So people are signing up very young children for extra physical therapy for their low muscle tone, for example, or getting them into special learning programs at a very young age.
So are there any specific treatments geared towards the chromosome variations themselves?
So there's nothing we do directly. So there is no gene therapy or things like this at this point at all. But what we can do is now know kind of what package you might be in for. One mom told me she felt like it was a roadmap so that you then knew what to look out for. Because it's a spectrum disorder, your particular child or you yourself as an individual may or may not have that issue. But when you know what to keep an eye out for, then you can manage it. So, for example, getting your child evaluated and into special education programs, for example. And then also helping to learn more, because, as I said, it is an invisible disability. And that's the difference with chromosome variations. You can't tell by looking at someone that they have an extra chromosome. So it's also, we want to help people, you know, understand what's going on with them and their children. And many times it's also educating the educators, people in the workplace, and things like that. So making sure those protections are in place for people.
So in your time with AXIS, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
I would say yes, definitely. The biggest success story is just being with other people who get it. So for so many individuals, and I'll give an example. We had this amazing family who had been a part of our organization for years, and they had a son. They have a son who has XXY, and he helped us obtain a grant, which was really wonderful to do, to educate physicians on this condition. So his son came to our conference. He's now a teenager. And for him to come and be in the company of many other young men, just like himself, it was life-changing. He said, oh my gosh, I get it. And it's so nice to be in a room full of people who understand why it is just your T-shirt cannot have tags, and why noises and things bother you, and why you're so tired at the end of the day, and the struggles you had in school, all these different things. So part of it really is that support piece of to not feel like an outsider anymore, but to really be around people who understand. And that's for an individual with a condition, but also for the parents and the family members of people who are trying to support individuals with a condition. It's just so incredibly helpful. So that's why our number one thing is support. And then the education is as well, so you know what to do with it. And I think also the hope and the treatment of getting into the right clinics. There are scientific research studies that we find amazingly helpful because we screen them really carefully, and you can go in and get this great scientifically validated evaluation, know exactly what to look for, what help you might need, and that can be game-changing. That's life-changing.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need for inclusion of those affected, what would you say?
Everyone has gifts and talents, and everyone has challenges. So when you see somebody who's different than you, don't jump to a conclusion. Take a little look for a minute, and then maybe see if there's some information. I know when I started working for AXIS and I started understanding the conditions, I could see in my life some people that might even have some of these conditions, and it helped me understand better. And everyone has talent. So people, there are so many artists and just different people. I've met many of the guys at Kleinfelter are amazing chefs. So to look for the talents in everyone, I think that's the biggest message I would find. And then to be understanding on everyone's challenges, because we all have them.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. In this next segment of our show, we'll hear from Sherry Martin Susar, who'll be telling us a little bit about Creative OT. So tell me a little bit about Creative OT.
So we are an occupational therapy clinic based in Waterloo. We have a gym area where we call our fine water room, where we have like a desk and we work on different activities that are more seated in nature, and we have a kitchen, and we see people individually, or we run different group sessions.
So can you give me an overview of some of the benefits of your work?
The main goal of being an occupational therapist is to help people to build on their independent living skills and help people to be able to do whatever it is they need to do better or easier, or with less stress, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, all those domains.
So what are some of the challenges in finding the right balance for someone who needs OT?
So one of the challenges could be funding. So I'm a fee-for-service clinic, and not everybody has access to extended health care benefits. And even if they do have access to extended health care benefits, not all extended health care benefit carriers actually will pay for occupational therapy services. So there's other funding avenues that people can get, but it can be a little tricky to find that. So that's actually one of the biggest barriers I find for occupational therapy. And if you look in the publicly funded world, there isn't a lot of access to occupational therapy there either.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time doing OT, what's been the greatest success you've witnessed?
The greatest success I've witnessed? I have one of my clients, the 70-year-old woman who had a traumatic leg amputation due to a car accident, and I was working with her on helping her modify her home environment, modify her daily activities, and helping her learn what her new normal was. And it was such a pleasure working with this woman, because the day she got her prosthesis and started to walk, started to regain her independence, she was so grateful for that opportunity. And she just had this wonderful spirit of gratitude and positivity that really helped her carry along the rehab process. That for me was one of the more special moments. I had another moment where I was working with a boy with autism who has autism and depression and anxiety, and things just weren't working well for him, and he was going through some really rough times. So I started working with him on an art project, and this art project entailed using cement on a plywood base, where you would actually make the cement go into a sort of abstract pattern. And then once that was dry, you paint the cement. So in his abstract pattern, he looked up and drew Egyptian hieroglyphs for symbols for you and I. And then when he showed his mom this, he said, This painting has double meaning. It's called You and I, as in the letters You and I. And then he gave his mom a hug. He said, or you and I together. And that was really special, because oftentimes children with autism can't think sort of in the abstract. And here he was creating this really cool art piece, taking pride in it, and then thinking about it in the abstract.
So for the first case you mentioned mm-hmm. that you did some home modifications. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the adaptations you made?
Mm-hmm. So I worked with a company that does home renovations, specifically to modify homes after people have been in accidents or if they need to have some kind of adaptive environment. So we worked together to change the bathroom. So this woman loved to have a bath, so we got her a bathtub that had a bath lift in it, so she could just sit on the bath lift and it motors down. She could enjoy her bath and then it powers back up. But she also had a wheel-in shower, so she could just wheel in a commode and have a shower if she wanted to have a shower that way. And we adapted the toilet so it was a higher toilet, and they had bars that can come down or flip back if needed to help her with her transfers. Then we also worked together to get her an elevator so she could access all levels of her house, so that she was able to sort of access her basement, because when you have a prosthesis, it's really hard to carry things up and down the stairs. And one of her goals is canning, and she always liked to store all of her canning equipment in the basement. She couldn't actually access it. So this really helped sort of get her back to some of the things that she found meaningful in her life.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Hey everyone, I'm Cassie.
And I'm Angel, and we are fourth-year nursing students who will be taking over hosting No Scrubs, a show all about health topics and education.
You can expect insightful conversations and even some exciting guest appearances by other healthcare professionals. Catch us on CJM Radio, 99.1 FM. New episodes airing every Tuesday at noon.
You can also tune in Wednesdays at 4:30 p.m. during our encore or at cjam.ca if you miss an episode.
Hope to catch you there.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Carol Mearshart from AXIS and from Sherry Martin Susar from Creative OT. In this segment of our show, we're going to hear from Maureen FitzHenry from the Canadian Museum of Human Rights. Tell me a little bit about some of the accessibility features at the Human Rights Museum.
Well, the Canadian Museum for Human Rights has really tried to incorporate inclusive design and universal accessibility into all aspects of its operations. So, yes, into our exhibits, also into our public programs, but into our corporate culture as well. So because we're a relatively new museum, we could kind of start from that point. And so really, everything that we do here, whether it's putting something on our website, whether it's making a decision about facility maintenance, whether it's creating a new exhibition, we're thinking about people with all different sorts of abilities and how it's going to affect them.
So I know from my own visit there that you have someone providing direction with a vision impairment.
Yeah, it's actually much more than that. What we've tried to do is, in terms of vision for people who are blind or have low vision, create an experience for them that is rich and independent, so that the idea being that they could come through on their own and experience all the exhibits, all the spaces. What we've done is incorporate 150, we call them eye beacons. They're low-energy Bluetooth technology at 150 universal access points. And so that when people get near to these access points and they're using our mobile app, it'll flow information to their app so that their text-to-speech reader can tell them things that they wouldn't know otherwise, like what does it say on the wall? What is the shape of this gallery? What are different points of information that you would miss if you being blind or low vision? And there are cane stops on the floor, tactile strips that people can access with their canes to alert them that a universal access point is nearby. So that's one of the really important ways that we try to provide a great experience here for those type of people.
So are there any challenges in developing accessible spaces and opportunities for the museum?
Yeah, there's all kinds of challenges. There's all kinds of opportunities as well. I think what our big opportunity was that we began as a brand new museum that opened its doors in 2014, and we could take advantage of a few things. We could take advantage, for once, of all the people who could help us, who have an array of disabilities from across the country. So we established an Inclusive Design Advisory Council. And so they told us right off the bat what we were doing wrong, what wasn't inclusive enough, what wasn't designed properly, what they needed. And so we were able to respond to a lot of those things and try to make a better experience and build the whole museum and the whole experience within the museum from scratch with those things in mind, as opposed to sort of adding them on afterwards. So, and the other really big advantage we had, the big opportunity we had, was the technology that's available now, the assistive technology that we could use, incorporate the smart phones, the other types of things, to make sure that that our exhibits were accessible to almost everyone.
So, in your time with the museum, in terms of accessibility, what's been the greatest success story you've witnessed?
I think just having that, the fact that we've really managed to incorporate a mindset at this museum that thinks about people with disabilities in everything we do. Like, there's nothing that we would even approach where we're not thinking right from the beginning, okay, is this going to be, how are we going to make this accessible to someone who is deaf or hard of hearing? What's the color contrast like? Is that going to work for someone who's low vision? Is it going to have seating, even if it's a temporary exhibit, accessible seating with backs and arms? How are we going to plug in for people who are or vision? Is there a space for someone with autism in case they need to sort of chill a little bit? So all those kinds of things. And I think that's really accessible to that we've managed to create that corporate culture, because you really, nothing else can come out of it unless you have that first. And then in our museum, we're very digitally based, so we have more than 100 hours of video, for example. And all of that video, we've got Describe audio, we've got ASL and LSQ sign language, we've got universal access points where people can plug in, we're thinking about the height of our text. So I could go on and on, but I think I feel like it's a big success to be able to tackle all of that.
So when it comes to someone with something like hearing loss, how do you go about making things accessible?
Well, we ensure that anything in the museum that involves sound, we're going to have both American Sign Language and Langue Signe Québécoise, the French version of that, incorporated in everything. We also have captioning on everything as well. We have people here who can, interface with the deaf and hard of hearing. We have coils to help people who are hard of hearing hear our things better. We think about the way that our mobile app is designed for those people as well. So it's not just audio. Everything is written out in there as well. So when I was telling you about the way that the iBeacons take the information from the universal access point, it's not only audio, it's also written if people would like to read it. And we have our programs as well, not just our exhibits, but we think about, okay, do we need sign language interpreters for these programs? Or what about having a deaf mime dance troupe come in, which we've done on occasion? Or how can we, in our exhibits, have some of the subject matter be the human rights issues that people who have various kinds of disabilities, including hearing loss, face? For sure.
You were saying something about a really unique photography exhibit.
Yeah, it was called Sight Unseen. We had it here in 2016, and it was photography by blind artists. So these people with various degrees of blindness and vision loss, ranging from complete and total blindness to being able to see little bits of things. But it was just about how they could actually communicate with the visioned world through photography and communicate some of their thoughts and feelings that way. And we had some of them come up as well. And in that exhibition, we also challenged our visitors to take photographs using assistive technology without being able to see what they were shooting. So that was really great. And then we also had in that exhibition some tactile versions of photographs where people could actually experience the artwork through their fingertips. So they wouldn't have to have someone describe the photograph to them. They could actually see it, in quotation marks, themselves through their fingers with the help of some tactile buttons that gave audio cues as well. And we've since replicated that experience in two additional exhibitions, including one we've got on right now about the Rohingya crisis. So that's been great. And then in another exhibition we had for Canada 150 called Our Canada, My Story, one of the people that we focused on in that exhibition was a man with cerebral palsy who was one of the lead theatrical performers and dancers in a troupe in Calgary. So, again, trying to show people challenging their boundaries and trying to redefine perceptions about what it means to have disability.
So I'm guessing for these blind and low vision photographers, their cameras used a form of described video.
Some of them did. Some of them didn't. Some of them just relied on very mathematical types of things, distances from their subjects, maybe audio light meter reading. Some of them used people to help them tell them things about where the the subject was or what the light reading would be like. And then some of them used a lot of assisted technology. So it was all kinds of approaches.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. I was especially impressed, folks, by what the Human Rights Museum has taken into consideration for people with various disabilities. For the fact is, human rights stories are disability stories, many cases. For the fact is, any oppressed group, any marginalized community has a greater chance of incurring some of those disabilities. Think about it. You can't get access to decent employment. You can't get decent transportation. You can't get decent health care. What do you think that's going to do? If nothing else, it's going to produce stress and strain. But the fact is, having a representation of this, a chance to share human stories, putting a real face on these matters, really is breaking down those barriers and those stereotypes. And I love that story from Creative OT earlier in our episode, wherein that child was able to express something so meaningful. Fact is, you never know what's going on in the heart and the mind of anyone. But when they choose to share a story and make a statement that I am a person with a disability, I am a meaningful part of this community, changes everything, my friends. Truth is, we have a very simple choice as onlookers. We can choose to say we're comfortable in our homogenized ways of thinking and we'll just go around and around for the rest of time, really. Or we can say, I'm curious about that. I want to know more about that. What is it that makes this person's story stand out for me? How is it we're in a world with such incredible diversity, such uniqueness of people, that we wouldn't want to know more about it? We just rest on our own laurels saying, the world is what it is, it's not going to change. Stagnation never leads to progress, my friends. And if we don't allow ourselves to hear those voices and share those stories, we never realize not only what types of people are out there, what strength really is. Many people would argue that that child was just not someone you can communicate with, not someone you can reach. But the therapist took the time, made the effort to get to know this child, saw him create something not only remarkable in its own right, but deeply touching. I can only imagine how his mother felt in receiving that. Fact is, you're making an impact, no matter what you do. No matter the message you send to a person, you are making an impact. And if you keep working at it, if you keep dispelling those myths and saying, we can challenge this preconception, you will make an impact, because someday someone's going to hear that voice. And especially to a child, they're built on what we tell them at a young age. They're built on, you can do this, you should try this, or no, that's not safe. That's not something you can ever do. It's a question. What are we creating into them? What are we building for the future? Are we building a generation of people who are too shy to say anything, to ask a question, to learn, to think about the things we do? Or are we creating a generation of daring, strong, outgoing people who are going to make the world a better place than it is today? The choice rests with each one of us. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.